I'm going to try to tie in some of what we said last time to a few different topics we've seen in the course. And then for the rest of the week, it's going to be various interpretations of quantum mechanics. So today is meant to basically just drive home a little bit further how difficult it is to interpret quantum theory in terms of hidden variables. So I told you last time about this generalized notion of measurement and preparation non-contextuality. And I said at the very end that it's not possible to find a preparation non-contextual hidden variable model for quantum theory, but I didn't show you the proof of that. So that's where we're going to start. So let me remind you of the definition of a preparation non-contextual hidden variable model. So the idea is that anytime you have two preparations like these, which are equivalent with respect to their statistics, so for all measurements, the probability of the different outcomes for the two measurements are the same for preparations P and P prime, then you should represent them by the same distribution over the ontic states lambda. So in a picture, for two guys in the same equivalence class, there should be the same distribution over lambda. That's a preparation non-contextual model. Whereas in a preparation contextual model, you have different distributions for these two preparations, even though they generate the same statistics. Okay. So what I'm going to try to describe to you is the kind of the best possible type of proof, which is one that you could directly test experimentally. So we saw that in the case of Bell's theorem. There's an inequality that you can just go to the lab and test, and it tells you what kind of world you're in, one that obeys local causality or one that doesn't, even if quantum theory turns out to be false. So this is meant to be an operational test of preparation non-contextuality that doesn't quite achieve the ideal of being independent of the validity of quantum theory, but almost does. And again, it's going to be phrased as a kind of game, because that's usually the easiest way of understanding these sorts of things. So the game is that you have these two contestants, Alice and Bob. And now a difference from the case of the Bell experiment is that Alice and Bob aren't space-like separated. Alice is sending signals to Bob. Okay, so they're actually communicating to one another. And then there's a referee, who I'll call Victor the verifier. And the way the game works is this. Victor is going to send two bits to Alice, call them x0 and x1. And then Alice gets to communicate to Bob. And then Victor sends one bit to Bob, called y. And Bob returns him a bit B. And the idea is that Victor's just asking Bob through Y. He's specifying whether he wants Bob to report X0 or to report X1. So Y is either 0 or 1, and they win if the bit that Bob sends back, B, is just X sub Y. So Victor might say, tell me what the first bit I gave to Alice was, and if Bob reports that back accurately, they win. He might say, tell me what the second bit I reported was. The values of these bits are drawn uniformly at random. The value of this bit is drawn uniformly at random. Okay, so far what I've described is easy to win. You know, Alice just sends the two bits over to Bob, and he just reports whichever one that Victor wanted. So to make it interesting, there's a catch. The catch is that in this transmission that Alice sends to Bob, there can't be any information about the parity of the two bits. So the parity of the two bits is just their sum modulo 2. So the strings 0, 0, and 1, 1 both have parity 0, and the strings 0, 1, and 1, 0 have parity 1. And so the idea is that the verifier is going to perhaps occasionally check whether there's any information going down this channel about the parity. Yes? Well, I'm going to consider both cases. The beauty of an operational framework is you don't need to specify that sort of thing. I can describe the whole protocol just in terms of the classical inputs and outputs of their devices, and then I can leave it sort of free whether this is going to be classical information or quantum information. And that's usually how people do it in quantum information theory. You can then compare a classical world with a quantum world by making that sort of substitution. So we're going to see that doing it with a quantum system is going to provide an advantage. But for now, I'm describing this in a completely general way, so it'll apply to any theory, any operational theory, not just classical or quantum. So that's the catch, that no information about the parity of the two can get through. So Alice is not allowed to send just x0 and x1 to Bob, because if she sent both, then all the information about the parity would be there in the message. So is that clear? Good. Let's see how well you could do in a classical world. So start by looking at the deterministic strategies. So suppose Alice evaluated some function that depended non-trivially on both x0 and x1, and she sent the value of that function to Bob. Well, that would violate the constraint, because any function that depends non-trivially on both of them has some information about their parity. Because if you can get some information about both x0 and x1, you can get some information about the parity. So she can only send those functions that depend non-trivially on either x0 or depend non-trivially only on x1. And so without loss of generality, you can imagine that she just sends x0, because that doesn't violate the constraint, and she can't send any information about x1 in addition to this. So suppose that's their protocol. Alice just sends the first bit, and they've agreed to this ahead of time. Bob knows that she's always just going to send the first bit. Well, then their probability of success is going to be 3/4, because with probability half, Victor's going to ask for the first bit, and then they're going to win the game with probability 1 in that case. But with probability half, he's going to ask for the second bit, and Bob has no information about the second bit, so the best he can do is just guess what its value is. But he happens to guess right half the time. So he'll just send Bob, Victor, a guess. He wins half the time. So the overall probability is 3/4. And any mixture of these different strategies, like maybe sometimes she sends x0, sometimes she sends x1, it can't do any better than the best deterministic strategy, as we saw in the case of Bell's theorem. So this is the optimum that you could possibly do in a classical world. 3/4 probability of success for this kind of game. Now, imagine, so before telling you about the quantum case, I want to give you the intuition that maybe contextuality can help you with these sorts of games. So imagine a different world. This is not classical, not quantum, but some imaginary world, very similar to what we saw in the restricted statistical theory of bits. So we imagine that every system has 4 internal states. I could put this on a 2x2 if I wanted to. And I imagine that unlike the theory we saw before, they can be prepared in any one of these 4 ontic states. So you can make sure that you've prepared one of them. But now there's a limitation on the measurements. So you can't do any old measurement. You can't, for example, find out which of the 4 states the system is in. But you could do this one, distinguish 1 and 2 versus 3 and 4. Or you could distinguish 1 or 3 versus 2 or 4. But the other natural candidate, you can't do that one either. Okay, so you can't distinguish 1 or 4 from 2 or 3. So suppose they follow, this is the world they're living in, then Alice can just encode her 2 bits into one of these preparations. So she just writes them down as a string, 00011011, and for each of the 4 possibilities, she prepares one of these 4 guys. And then if Bob wants, say, the first bit, x0, he measures this, because the first 2 are the cases where the first bit is 0, and the second 2 states are the case where the first bit is 1. And similarly, if he wants the second bit, he measures this, because remember, it's 00011011. And so these 2 guys are the case where the second bit is 0, and these 2 guys are the case where the second bit is 1. So Bob can get all the information about the first bit and the second bit. But to get information about the parity, well, that would be to distinguish this pair from this pair, because this is 00, this is 11, that's parity 0, this is parity 1. So he'd have to be able to do this measurement. And this imaginary world says that measurement's not allowed, so Bob can't find out about the parity. Okay, so in this kind of world, the probability of success in this task is 1, and it satisfies that constraint. Okay, so this is a great world to live in if you care about doing this kind of game well. But there's something strange about this world, which is that you could always do other preparations. Like you could flip a coin and decide to do this preparation or this preparation with probability of half each. So that would be this kind of preparation. It would be this distribution over the ontic states. Or you could flip a coin and do this guy with probability half or this guy with probability half. And that would be this distribution. And now what's weird is that these two very different ways of preparing the physical state of the system are completely indistinguishable at the operational level. In this world, there's no measurement you could do that would allow you to tell these guys apart. And you might say, well, that's a bit strange that there's this distinction at the hidden variable level, right? They're clearly very different distributions. In fact, they have disjoint support. In a sense, they couldn't be more distinguishable at the hidden variable level. And yet, at the operational level, there's no measurement that can tell them apart. And this is exactly what was defined as preparation contextuality, when things that are indistinguishable operationally are distinguishable ontologically. So you could say, all right, well, that we've now got one example of a world where you can do better than 3/4 at this task, but the price you pay is that it has this feature of preparation contextuality. Let me give you a second of it. Well, it's not yet an example of this, but let's look at the quantum case. And ultimately, I'll show you that all worlds that do better than 3/4 have to be preparation contextual. So here's a quantum protocol for the same scheme. Alice is going to send Bob a single two-dimensional quantum system, just one qubit. Depending on what the value of the two bits that Victor has sent her are, she's either going to prepare one of these four quantum states. And then, depending on the value of y, Bob's either going to measure this basis here or this basis here, right, corresponding to antipodal points on the Bloch sphere for a qubit. And so if you look here, I mean, let's say y is equal to 0, so Bob's interested in guessing the first bit. Well, if this is the state that Alice has prepared, then he's more likely to get this outcome than this outcome, which means that he should guess 0 when he gets this outcome, and he should guess 1 when he gets this outcome. So for these guys here where the first bit's 1, he'll most of the time get this outcome, and he'll guess correctly. And for these states here where the first bit is 0, most of the time he'll get this outcome, and he'll guess correctly. And the probability that he guesses correctly is, again, that sort of approximately 85% that we've seen before. Similarly, if he wants the second bit, then he just measures here, and he guesses 0 for this outcome. And when the states are these guys, the second bit is 0, and he's more likely to get this outcome than outcome, and vice versa over here. So in all these cases, he guesses correctly with probability about 85%. And he satisfies the constraint, right? That if you look at whether he can get any information about the parity, well, the two parity zero states here, which you know occur with equal probability, if I take the mixture of them, I just land at the center of the Bloch sphere. And if I take the mixture of the two parity one states, I also get to the center of the Bloch sphere. That's just the fact that, you know, different mixtures of pure states can give the same mixed state. But we also know that if I have two preparations and they're represented by the same mixed state, there is no measurement that can tell them apart. All measurements have exactly the same statistics for those two preparations. So what it says is that no matter what Bob measures, you know, forget doing these measurements. Let's say he's trying to, or somebody's trying to cheat and get information about the parity. No matter what they measure, they'll get no information about the parity. So this does better than the classical case. It's better than 75%. And so you'll notice this. There's a similarity that, you know, it performs at 85% rather than 75%. That's very much like what we saw in the Bell game. And I'll come back to that connection later in the lecture. Right. So this, by the way, this is one of the very first protocols in quantum information theory. So I think on one of these slides earlier, I called this game, I called it parity oblivious multiplexing. So the idea here is it's multiplexing in the sense that Bob can extract the first bit or he can extract the second bit. He can't do both because he can't measure necessarily. He can't do both measurements at the same time. So we see that in the quantum case, right? He either has to choose to do this measurement or this measurement. But he can get the information about either bit. So it's sort of like you're using the one and the same channel to transmit two bits, but the receiver has to decide which one they're going to take out, and you're doing it in this parity oblivious way. So Steven Wiesner in the 70s came up with this idea for multiplexing. He wasn't so concerned about the parity, making sure that no information about the parity gets through. But it sort of, I think it got rejected from the first journal he sent it to, and then eventually when quantum information started becoming more somehow acceptable, it did get published. And now, you know, people describe these things in quantum information theory. Nowadays, they're more typically called random access codes. All right, but back to the story about contextuality. So the claim is that every operational theory that does better than the classical one, better than three quarters, is going to have to be preparation contextual. So it has to fail to be preparation non-contextual. So let me give you a proof of that. And because we saw that quantum theory is better than three quarters, it will also be preparation contextual. So you can also think of this as a proof that you can't have a preparation non-contextual model of quantum theory. So here's the idea that whatever Alice does in response to getting some bit string from Victor, it's she's going to do some preparation procedure. So I'll call that PX0X1. So she just implements whichever one of these four preparations corresponds to the bit string she got. And then over here, Bob knows that he has to return a bit to Victor. So he's going to have to do a two outcome measurement. And he's going to have to choose his measurement based only on what Victor's asking him for. So whether y is 0 or 1 tells him whether to do measurement m0 or measurement m1. He could, you know, if he did a measurement with more outcomes, he would always have to decide whether he's going to submit the answer 0 or 1. So he could just coarse grain the outcomes of that measurement to, you know, all of these will lead me to guess 0 and all of these will lead me to guess 1. So there's no loss of generality in saying that he's going to do a two outcome measurement. okay, so again, you know, this is generic, any theory I can describe in this way. And now I can describe two new preparation procedures, which are just the cases where you do P00 with probability half and P11 with probability half. That's like the parity zero preparation. And this is the case where you do P01 or P10 with probability half each. And that you can think of as an effective parity one preparation. And now the constraint that there should be no information about the parity is that no matter what measurement is done on this after this preparation procedure, the statistics for that measurement should be exactly the same for the preparation of parity 1 and the preparation of parity 0. So this is just saying that no measurement can give us any information about parity. Okay, so here's the critical assumption. This is where the preparation non-contextuality comes in. This allows us to just apply the definition of preparation non-contextuality directly. That was defined as, you know, if there are two preparation procedures such that no measurement can distinguish them, then those two preparation procedures should be represented by the same distribution over the hidden variables. So that's just using the assumption. And now we're very close to the end. All you have to do is a Bayesian inversion on this. So remember that, let's just find some chalk here. The formula for Bayesian inversion is that if I want to know what the probability of B given A is in terms of the probability of A given B, I just multiply times the probability of B and divide by the probability of A, which is the same as, you know, the probability of A can also be written in terms of the sum over the possibilities for B of this. So in this case, we want to do exactly that kind of Bayesian inversion. I want to move the, yes? Okay, thanks. That's not it. So I want to apply that in this case. And so here I want to get, let's see. B is now going to be like this choice of this preparation, and A is going to be like lambda. And the point is that the prior probability of these two guys, so like the P of B there, is a half a half, because Victor's been choosing these strings uniformly at random. So it's equally likely that it's a parity 0 is parity 1. So therefore, I can just, the overall probability distribution over lambda is the same. The prior over lambda is the same. And so when I do the Bayesian inversion, I just get this, that the probability of the parity being 0, given that the ontic state is lambda, is exactly the same as the probability that the parity is 1, given the ontic state lambda. So the point is this, that even if you could measure the ontic state precisely, and typically in a hidden variable model, you can't do that. There's some restriction on how much you can know. But even if you couldn't know it precisely, it would still tell you nothing about the parity if your model is preparation non-contextual. So effectively, what's going on in this model is that there's an ontic state, some hidden variables, that can communicate information about this string over to this side. But those guys contain no information about the parity. And they're like a classical signal, right? The hidden variables are behaving classically, and I do calculations on the distribution of those hidden variables using classical probability theory. So basically, lambda satisfies all the same constraints as the classical protocol we just saw. So using a classical message, which is what lambda is, we already saw that you can't do any better than 3/4. So this is a classical message that has no information about the parity. So what could it possibly encode? It could encode x0, or it could encode x1. And if it only encodes one of the bits, then on the other end, at best, you could guess correctly the outcome with probability 3/4. So every preparation non-contextual model is bounded in its probability of success for this task. So you could think of this as a inequality for preparation non-contextuality. It's like a Bell inequality. Any operational theory that is preparation non-contextual has to satisfy this inequality. Any theory that violates it can't have this kind of model. Now, you can, as I said, do an experimental test of this sort of thing. So you go to the lab, you have your, say, 4 preparation procedures corresponding to the strings, your 2 measurements. You just calculate the statistics for each of your measurements and each of your 4 preparations. From those statistics, you can calculate your probability of success. And what you want to do is verify that this thing is greater than 3/4, and also verify that these 2 effective preparations cannot be distinguished by any measurement. So if you go and you do all that in the lab, then you end up having good evidence that, you know, the world does not admit of a preparation non-contextual model, regardless of whether the world satisfies quantum theory or not. The one caveat here, the reason there was an almost in the first slide, is because you can't really do all measurements. So typically what you do is you rely on what you know about quantum theory to some extent to decide when to sort of stop doing measurements and say, it really looks as if there's no information about the parity coming through this channel. So what the experimentalists do is they do 4 preparations that, to their estimation, are as close as possible to these quantum states, and 2 measurements are as close as possible to these measurements. And they indeed find a violation of that inequality, but a satisfaction of this constraint. So there's good evidence that we can't have this kind of non-contextuality for our world. So questions about that? Yes.
So, if you have something that's non-contextual in preparation, it means that we don't have any principle to. There's some difference in the underlying hidden variables, but we have no way of determining it.
That's right.
But it affects experimental outcomes because we have the inequality violation.
That's right. So it's like saying, you know, although there's no way of discriminating these two things, the only way to explain the correlations between different possible preparations, or let me say it this way, let me finish what I'm saying. The only way to explain the correlation between the different possible preparations and the different measurement outcomes is with a model that has different distributions. But I guess note that there are, you know, really six preparations here. There's, you know, each of these four guys, and then there's the mixture of these two and the mixture of these two. And it's those two mixtures that are not distinguishable one from the other. But when we look at the statistics, we're looking at cases where we've done these preparations here. It's something about the structure of how all those correlations hang together that cannot be explained within this sort of hidden variable model. Yes?
Is there any practical reason to choose that? I mean, we cannot know anything. We shouldn't know anything about the parity.
Do you mean, like, is this particular game a cryptographically interesting protocol?
Yeah.
Not that I know of. But the CHSH game, which we saw in the Bell lecture, also was kind of just invented because it fixed, you know, you can get an improvement for it using quantum mechanics. But since that time, people have found ways, as I've said, you know, with the quantum spellcraft, of using Bell inequalities to do things that you're actually interested in. So it's conceivable that you might find other games that are actually of real interest to computer scientists for which contextuality could provide an advantage. I think that's a good topic for research, really. All right, let's move on. So first thing I want to point out is that from this way of looking at things, what's mysterious about this kind of contextuality is that you have these non-contextuality inequality violations, which means that your distributions over the hidden variables do depend on the preparation context. But there's no way to use that context dependence to communicate information. So your measurement statistics are independent of the preparation context. So for example, what it tells us is if a hidden variable theory is true, then there really is information about the parity that's communicated from Alice to Bob. And yet, Bob can't get any of that information of parity out. And there seems like a tension there. So remember, in the case of Bell's theorem, it seemed like there must be information going from Alice over here about her setting to Bob, and yet they couldn't use that to signal. So it's the same sort of thing here. So it's exactly the same kind of tension as we find in non-locality between what would seem to be the necessity of superluminal causes, if you believe that the correlations have to be explained causally, and the fact that there's no way to make use of those superluminal causes to send signals. So it's precisely the same kind of tension, but taken from a space-like separated context to a time-like separated context. So as I mentioned earlier, there's an even stronger connection with the particular proof of non-locality we saw last week. So let me just remind you what it was. You have two systems that are prepared. A two-outcome measurement is done on each of them. So here, and there's one of two possibilities for the measurement. And the game was try to generate these kinds of correlations. And we showed that if you have local hidden variables, then at best you can win this game with probability 75%. But if we prepare this quantum state, which is entangled, and over here we measure either this basis or this basis in the block sphere, and here we measure the diagonal bases, then we find that in these three cases we have 85% correlation, and in this case we have 85% anti-correlation, and so we do violate that inequality. We have an overall probability of success of about 85%. Now, what I want you to do is think about that same protocol as a kind of steering. So let's forget about this measurement for the moment. Let's suppose it's not done. So what we have is two systems that are entangled, and a measurement is done on this one. So you've seen this a few times already in your tutorial and your homework where you were calculating how to update the quantum state of system B given your measurement on system A. And in this particular quantum example, if in the block sphere you're measuring this basis or this basis, well, what happens over on the other end, it starts out, the reduced density operator for B in the beginning is just the complete mixed state at the center of the block sphere. And then you say you get outcome 0, then you update it to this state. So the distance system B gets updated to 0 when you find system A in state 0. If you find system A in state 1, you update the distance system to 1. That's this here. And similarly here, if you measure plus and minus, you update the distance system to plus or minus. And remember that you saw that if we have a kind of hidden variable model like this one, we could think of that steering phenomena as just Bayesian updating. So you do, say, this measurement or this measurement on a pair of force. So two systems, they each have four ontic states. Whatever the ontic state of the first guy is, the ontic state of the second guy is exactly the same. So when I find the ontic state of A in one of these two guys, I learn that the ontic state of the other guy is one of the two. And similarly, if it's one of these two guys, then I learn that he's one of those two guys. And so there was a picture here that, oh, maybe what's going on in steering is just Bayesian updating. I'm learning something about the physical state of the distant system. But all along, it was in some one of the four possibilities. Like maybe it was here, in which case, if I do this measurement over here, I get this outcome. Whereas if I do this measurement over here, I get this outcome. So this is just two ways of resolving my knowledge about the reality in the distant system. The reality doesn't change as I choose the measurement over here. Just my knowledge of it changes. So we had that sort of picture of steering, and it seemed kind of compelling. But it's something that you can't have in quantum theory, it turns out. At least you can't think of it that way as Bayesian updating about local hidden variables. So why is that? Well, let's rewrite this quantum one just in terms of the formalism. So we're saying that if we do a measurement of this basis on A, then the completely mixed state for B gets updated to 0 or 1 with probabilities a half each. And the mixture of those two guys is just the original state, right? So that's the sense in which it's like Bayesian updating. You're going from a mixed state to some element in the decomposition of that mixed state with the probabilities corresponding to the weights in the decomposition. And similarly here, you're just making a transition from identity to one of the states in its convex decomposition. So what it suggests for a hidden variable model is that the original entangled state should be a state of correlation between hidden variables lambda A and lambda B. So these are ontic states for systems A and B. So they start out correlated with some marginal on B. And then you do some measurement corresponding to the probability of getting outcome 0 given lambda A versus the probability of getting outcome 1 given lambda A. Some set of indicator functions measures A. And you update your knowledge about B from whatever it was initially to, you know, one of two distributions, mu naught, mu 1, depending on what outcome you got. So if everything were like Bayesian updating, then if I mix these two final distributions with the probability that I get them, I should get the initial distribution back. So that the updating is just picking out one term in this decomposition. That's what things should be like if it's purely Bayesian updating. And similarly here, when I look at the final distributions I assign here, I should be able to mix them back to the initial distribution. But notice that that assumption, that the mixture of the two quantum states, zero vector, one vector, mixing to identity, should be given by these two equations, that's an assumption of preparation non-contextuality. Because it says that although you know, this mixture and this mixture are different preparations, the fact that they're represented by the same quantum state, i.e. the fact that there's no measurement that can tell them apart, tells us that they should be represented by the same distribution. Okay, so that's it could have been that these distributions were different, nu and nu prime. Because after all, the two preparation procedures are different. But in this case, that assumption of preparation non-contextuality is justified by locality. Had these two distributions been different, nu and nu prime, it would say that what you chose to measure over here influences the overall distribution of the ontic states at the distant system. So there would have to be some influence, non-local influence, and you wouldn't be able to interpret things purely as Bayesian updating. And so in this case, our assumption of preparation non-contextuality is justified by locality. And therefore, if you find a contradiction, if from preparation non-contextuality you can derive a contradiction, then you've also derived a contradiction from locality. So you could turn a proof of contextuality into a proof of non-locality. And it turns out it's the two proofs we've now seen, the proof of non-locality and the proof of preparation contextuality, actually have this relationship to one another. So let me convince you of that. So if in our steering problem we now put in a measurement on this side of this basis or this basis, Then you're preparing one of these four states, and you're doing this measurement or this measurement, and that's exactly the setup that we just saw for this multiplexing problem. Okay, so the way Alice prepared things was she just chose, or well, Victor gave her one of the four strings, she prepared one of the four states, and then this measurement was done. Of course, this is a rotation by 45 degrees of what we saw before, but it's the same structure. So if instead of Alice doing it that way, it was these four preparations were chosen by doing a measurement on half of an entangled state and collapsing to one of these four states, nothing changes. All the statistics are exactly the same. But now you can say, well, the fact that the distribution over hidden variables should be the same for this mixture and for this mixture is ultimately vindicated by locality. Because otherwise, the choice of measurement over here would influence the overall distribution at the far side. So in this context, locality does imply the assumption of preparation non-contextuality we need to get this proof to work. And what we showed before was that that gave us a contradiction with the actual observed statistics. The assumption of preparation non-contextuality said that you would never be able to guess, you know, bit one or bit two with probability greater than 75%, and yet the quantum statistics give us 85%. And it's exactly the same 75 and 85% that we had in the non-locality proof. I'm just sort of reinterpreting this one experiment in one of two different ways, either as correlations between these two measurements, or rather as thinking about all of this, the measurement as a preparation for this device. So there's a map between these two kinds of proofs. So the bottom line is that sometimes these proofs of contextuality are even stronger. They give you a proof of non-locality. And steering, this EPR steering effect that we've seen over and over, cannot be understood as Bayesian updating, pure Bayesian updating in a hidden variable model of this sort, a non-contextual in variable model. So that's a sense in which, you know, all this stuff that we've seen so far in the course, which, you know, makes this interpretation of quantum states seem really compelling, contextuality and non-locality are a problem for trying to understand things in this sort of way. So let me pause there. Clear? Let's move on to talk a bit more about measurement non-contextuality. So again, I'll remind you what the definition was. So this is the generalized definition, not the traditional one. It said that if you have two measurements that give you the same statistics for all preparations, that's this here, then they should be represented by the same set of indicator functions. So if I now condition on the ontic state, I should get the same distribution over outcomes for M and M prime. So again, in terms of pictures, if these are two outcome measurements, then this is what a set of indicator functions might look like. It should be the same for both of them in a measurement non-contextual model. Whereas in a measurement contextual model, it might be different for this guy and this guy, even though they give the same statistics. And again, you know, the reason that this seems like the non-contextual assumption seems a good one is that it's the simplest way of explaining the fact that these guys' statistics are exactly the same for all preparations. You know, they're measuring exactly the same sorts of things if this is the representation. Okay, so I want to compare this notion to the traditional notion, which we saw at the beginning of the lecture on Friday. So the traditional notion was that if you have, for example, two bases in a three-dimensional Hilbert space that have some element in common, like psi 1, then those should be represented by indicator functions such that the indicator function associated with that element is the same in both cases. So the first thing I want to point out is that, you know, this doesn't feel like saying, you know, there's two measurements that are represented exactly the same way, because what we're considering here are two different measurements. You know, there are these measurements give different statistics for certain kinds of preparations. So it doesn't feel like we're comparing two measurements that actually have the same statistics. But it's not hard to generate two such measurements. So the point is just that if you now consider a new measurement, M, I'll call it, which starts by measuring this basis and then coarse grains over outcomes 2 and 3, then this is how I would represent that measurement, as psi 1 versus identity minus psi 1. And the measurement M prime, which does the second basis in coarse grains, is represented by exactly the same pair of projectors. The point is that the sum of the projectors onto psi 2 prime and psi 3 prime is exactly the sum of psi 2 and psi 3. They both give me resolutions of that rank 2 projector here. And so the assumption of traditional non-contextuality can be phrased in terms of two measurements that are completely indistinguishable operationally. It just says that they should be represented by exactly the same pair of deterministic indicator functions. Because if chi 1 is the same in both these guys, and the indicator functions have to sum everywhere, well, then it means that chi for the other outcome, the not one outcome, have to be exactly the same as well. OK, so the only difference with this general notion was that in the traditional notion, we assume that these things are deterministic. It's always probability 0 or 1 for getting a particular outcome conditioned on lambda. Whereas in the general case, we allowed that there were some probabilities that were different from 0 or 1. So what it means is that this traditional notion I talked about at the beginning of the lecture on Friday is the revised notion of non-contextuality for projective measurements, together with an extra assumption that the outcome should be deterministic for a projective measurement. That once you specify the ontic state of the system coming into the device, the outcome of this projective measurement should be completely certain. So that's important. It means that this generalized definition is not just a generalization, it's a revision. It makes a different claim about what we should call non-contextual. And the innovation relative to the traditional one is a bit like the innovation of Bell's, when Bell went from local determinism to local causality. So we talked about this on the second lecture of non-locality. So local determinism was asking whether the outcome of some measurement depends on space-like separated events, in addition to depending just on the local settings at that device and on the ontic state that comes into it. But Bell, remember, wanted to be able to talk about theories wherein there might be some indeterminism. You know, things might be genuinely random. So he changed, he came up with a new notion of locality, where you ask instead whether the probability of the outcome of some measurement depends on space-like separated events or not. So rather than talking about the outcome, you talk about the probability of the outcome. And so that's exactly what's going on in this distinction between the traditional notion and this revised notion. The traditional notion asked whether the outcome of a measurement depends on the context of that measurement, whereas here you're asking just whether the probability of the outcome depends on the context. Okay, so it's useful to be able to separate the issue of determinism from the issue of locality, so that you can, you know, really test one independently of the other. And so similarly here, it's nice to be able to separate determinism from the issue of non-contextuality. So that's what the revised notion has going for it. But there's a problem now, because all the no-go theorems I showed you started from this assumption. So this is like a Merman's magic square argument, or Cauchon-Specker's original argument, or the one in terms of the five boxes, or what other one did I give you? Oh yeah, Cabello's 18 vector proof. All of those started from this assumption and derived a contradiction. But now, if you're more interested in this revised notion of non-contextuality, you don't necessarily have to give it up. Because in the face of a contradiction following from these two things, you could just give up determinism and salvage this notion of non-contextuality. So the question is, can you somehow salvage this revised notion of non-contextuality? It's the one, incidentally, that really sort of does justice to, it's the one that really captures this methodological principle that when two things don't differ operationally, then they shouldn't differ ontologically. The traditional notion captures that to some extent, but it has this admixture of determinism in it. Well, it turns out you can get around this because preparation non-contextuality, together with certain facts about quantum mechanics, perfect discrimination of orthogonal states in particular, turns out that implies that your projective measurements should have deterministic outcomes. So you don't need to assume it. You can derive it from another notion of non-contextuality, non-contextuality for preparations. So this is a fact about quantum mechanics. So let me take you through the proof of that. So this is going to vindicate all those no-go theorems we saw. Now we can say that they ultimately rest on assumptions of non-contextuality alone. So when they yield a contradiction with the predictions of quantum mechanics, we know that it's the non-contextuality that's at fault. And ultimately, we've justified the determinism in terms of non-contextuality. So here's the proof. Suppose you take some basis in a three-dimensional Hilbert space, and then you imagine the measurement associated with this basis. And now it's going to be a proof by contradiction. So suppose that these indicator functions are not deterministic. So there's some regions where they don't take value 0 and 1. I'm going to derive a contradiction from this. It's going to prove that these bases are going to have to be represented by deterministic indicator functions. But for the moment, I assume they're non-deterministic. And then I say, now imagine preparing one of these three states and then doing this measurement. Okay. So how will I have to represent that in the hidden variable model? Well, the distribution I associate with preparing psi 1, I'll call that mu psi 1 of lambda, it's going to have support entirely in the region of chi sub 1 that is assigned probability 1. Because we know from quantum theory that if I prepare psi 1 and then I measure this basis, I always get the first outcome. I never get the outcomes 2 or 3. And if this distribution extended into this region at all, then it would have some probability of getting outcome 2. And we know that doesn't happen. So I'm going to have to represent the distribution for psi 1 as something confined to this region, the distribution for psi 2 is something confined to the region where the indicator function for outcome 2 is 1 and nothing in this region, and similarly for any other basis states. And so there's this region here where none of these three preparation procedures can have any support. Okay, and now we just note that there has to be some states in the Hilbert space that have support in that region. Otherwise, we wouldn't have to assume that we just define a new hidden variable model that excluded that region entirely. So there has to be some quantum state in that has support in that region. And now here's the final step, which appeals to preparation non-contextuality. The completely mixed state, identity over 3, for this Hilbert space, can be written as an equal mixture of preparations of these three states. And in the hidden variable model, that means it's an equal mixture of the distributions associated with these three states. So, you know, for the particular way I've drawn it here, it would be sort of, you know, three peaks now with probability a third each. But it's also true that the completely mixed state can be written as a convex sum of a triple that includes psi. So for some other state psi, you'll always be able to find a triple of orthogonal states that include psi, such that if I mix those with equal weights, I get identity over 3. It's just like the qubit case. Any orthogonal basis for a Hilbert space, when I take the mixture of the projectors onto those orthogonal states, I get the completely mixed state. So there's also some decomposition of identity over 3 into psi and some other stuff with weight a third. And now in preparation non-contextuality tells me that these two distributions, even though they correspond to different mixtures, have to be exactly the same. They could have been different. It could have been that the mixture of psi 1, psi 2, and psi 3, and the mixture of psi and its two orthogonal partners were represented differently, but that would be a violation of preparation non-contextuality. Because both of those mixtures are associated with identity over 3, there's no measurement that can tell them apart. Therefore, we should represent them by the same distribution. But now we have our contradiction. Because if I look at the sum of these three distributions, it has no support in this region. But if I look at the sum of this distribution with its pairs, it has to have support in that region, because that's what I assumed about psi. It was a state that has that support. So I've derived my contradiction. It means that my starting assumption, that these indicator functions could be non-deterministic must be flawed under the assumption of preparation non-contextuality. Therefore, preparation non-contextuality implies outcome determinism for these measurements in quantum theory. So that means that these old proofs, which started with the traditional notion of non-contextuality and derived a contradiction, can now be based on measurement non-contextuality and preparation non-contextuality. So, you know, if I take these two things together, given that this implies outcome determinism, I get measurement non-contextuality and outcome determinism, and that's just equivalent to the traditional notion. So now any contradiction you derive, you can really pin it on non-contextuality rather than hoping to salvage non-contextuality by giving up determinism. Okay. And in addition to that, because this revised notion is more general, it refers to POVMs, for example, you get new proofs of measurement non-contextuality or new proofs of the impossibility of non-contextuality that you didn't have in the traditional literature. All right. So the final comment I want to make about measurement non-contextuality is that so far I haven't given you anything like an inequality that you could really go to the lab and try to violate and then have a conclusion about the way the world is. So if you really want that, if you want an experimental test of contextuality that doesn't depend on quantum theory, on the validity of quantum theory, then you need somehow an operational notion of a sharp measurement. So when I justified outcome determinism, let me just go back one more slide. When I justified this, I had to make reference to orthogonal states and talk about projective measurements. Those are all concepts that are native to quantum theory. If I'm in a general context, I don't have a notion of projective measurements because I might not have a Hilbert space. I might not have any projectors. So there is, in the quantum logic literature, something called sharp measurements, which are meant to be analogs of projective measurements for general theories. And there are different definitions of, you know, what a sharp measurement is. So the first thing you need to do is you need to fix some sort of operational notion of a sharp measurement, and then you need to justify outcome determinism for those guys. So we just saw it in the case of quantum theory. We justified determinism using a notion of non-contextuality. But that was a proof that was native to quantum theory. And we need a proof that's more general, that'll work for any operational theory. So what we really need is some experimental facts about sharp measurements in a general operational theory, probably something to do with sort of the perfect correlation between the outcomes of some measurement and preparation procedures, such that together with preparation non-contextuality, we can derive that those sharp measurements have to have determined outcomes. And if we could do all of that, then we could actually use all those traditional proofs that we saw on Friday and test them in the lab and make conclusions, you know, conclude that the world has to be contextual regardless of whether quantum theory is right or not. Currently, there's a literature on experimental tests of contextuality, but my opinion is they don't really meet the same standard that the tests of Bell's theorem do because they haven't been phrased in this operational way that's independent of the quantum formalism yet. So that's, you know, room for improvement in the future. Let me pause for questions about measurement non-contextuality. Clear? All right, only one more thing I wanted to tell you about all this, again, making a connection with some stuff you've seen before. And the stuff that you've seen, the stuff it's going to make a connection to is quasi-probability representations. For certain quantum theorists, quasi-probability representations, such as the Wigner representation, provide a criterion for classicality. So a quantum optician, for example, most quantum opticians have the following sort of slogan. If you do an experiment where you've managed to prepare a quantum state that has negative Wigner representation, then your experiment can't be explained classically. There's some non-classicality there. So here are some plots of different states, quantum states of the electromagnetic field for a mode. So this is just the vacuum state. This is the state where I have four photons. This is a coherent state superposed with another coherent state. So this is sometimes called a Schrodinger cat state. And these two guys here have Wigner representations that go negative. Okay, these are the Wigner representations for each. These two axes are the position and, well, the analogs of position and momentum for a quantum optical field, which you can think of as a harmonic oscillator. So if an experimentalist manages to verify that they've prepared one of these kinds of states, then they can say, ah, we've really done something non-classical. So there's a problem, though, with this notion of non-classicality. So first of all, it's better not to ask about whether a given preparation is classical or not. It's better to ask about a whole experiment. Can the statistics of that experiment, preparation plus measurements, be explained in some sort of classical way? And so you find that negativity of the Wigner function is not a necessary condition for non-classicality, because it could be that I'm doing an experiment where all the states I've prepared have positive Wigner functions, but the measurements, when I represent them in the Wigner representation, cannot be interpreted as conditional probabilities because they go negative. And so then you'd say, oh, that whole experiment doesn't admit of a classical explanation, even though all the Wigner functions of the states are positive. So that tells you that the negativity of the Wigner function for the states can't be a necessary condition for non-classicality. But it's not sufficient either, because you can find an experiment where the Wigner representations of the states and the measurements both go negative, but there's still a classical explanation on offer. So for example, if I prepared just number eigenstates or density operators that were diagonal in the number eigenstate basis, and then I did a measurement, and all the measurement operators are diagonal in the number state eigenbasis. Well, then there's a very simple classical way of modeling that, which is that I've got this hidden variable of number, I've prepared a probability distribution over it, and then I'm just doing noisy measurements of the number. So there's a classical explanation, it's just not the one offered by the Wigner representation. So if you want to have a kind of notion of classicality that which says that, you know, any kind of model goes, you know, it doesn't have to be phase space. It could be, you know, that different numbers are the different possible hidden states. Then you should say that, you know, there are experiments that have negative Wigner representations but can still be interpreted classically. So in that sense, you wouldn't want negativity of the Wigner representation to be a sufficient condition for non-classicality. What you'd really like to do is consider other representations besides the Wigner representation and ask, is there some representation in which all the preparations look like positive probability distributions over some space, and all the measurements look like positive conditional probabilities over that space? Okay, so let me say something generic about quasi-probability representations. You've basically only seen the Wigner representation, but you know there's a whole bunch of these things, and here's the properties they have. For every density operator, they assign some distribution over some space. So this space lambda doesn't have to be phase space if you're talking about a quasi-probability representation that isn't the Wigner representation. This could be some arbitrary space. You get some function over that space, but the key is that it's only a mapping from the space to the reals. It doesn't have to be positive. That's why it's called quasi-probability, because these things can go negative. So you saw that with the Wigner representation. There was a function over the phase space, but it sometimes went negative. It was still true, though, that that function integrated to 1 over the space. And over with the measurements, it's the same deal. You have these functions over the space that really should be interpreted as, you know, for every k, you have a function over the space, every outcome. But it's only a map to the reals. Had it been a map to the positive reals, you could think of this as a conditional probability of k given lambda. Certainly, if you sum over k, you get 1 for every lambda, but they can go negative. And then finally, you just demand that when I put them into this formula, I get the quantum statistics back. So in addition to the Wigner representation, which you've seen, there are things called the Q representation in quantum optics and the P representation. There's also Wigner representations for discrete systems, like qubits. And there are many others that all just meet this description and give you a way, an equivalent way, of representing your preparations and your measurements as functions over a space. the way to generate an arbitrary one of these is to just find a set of operators that forms a basis for the operator space. So the space of operators is also a vector space. You can find sets of operators that form bases for that space. You can decompose your states and your measurements in terms of those operators and get a quasi-probability representation. You can generate an infinite number of them. Yes? The Q representation is one where you you take the overlap of rho with an overcomplete basis of coherent states. So if you think of the vacuum state, and then you consider all translations in phase space of it, that set of states is not an orthogonal basis, but it's overcomplete. I can sum them up and get something proportional to identity. So it's like a basis of a vector space that just is not orthogonal. And so the Q representation is the representation in terms of that basis. So finally, if you take the spirit of the Wigner representation notion of classicality, and you apply it here, you can say, look, if you write down a quasi-probability representation for your experiment, and you find that the functions that represent the density operators are all positive, and the functions that represent the POVMs are all positive, then you have a classical explanation. Because you can really think of it as just not knowing what lambda is when you do the preparation, and the measurement revealing something about lambda. So this is a more general notion of classicality. It looks at all quasi-probability representations rather than just the Wigner representation. So that's sort of, you know, take two, classicality from non-negativity. So you say a quantum experiment is non-classical if it fails to admit any quasi-probability representation that's non-negative for all the states in the measurements. So this is just kind of an improvement over the notion of classicality defined in terms of Wigner. Seems reasonable. But now here's the main point I wanted to make, is that notion I've just introduced, non-negative quasi-probability representation, is exactly a non-contextual hidden variable model of quantum mechanics. They're the same notion. Because once I've assumed positivity, I can start thinking of these as distributions over the hidden variables, and these as conditional probabilities for the hidden variables, indicator functions. And the assumption of preparation non-contextuality is there in the fact that this is only allowed to depend on rho. I don't allow it to depend on anything else. So another way to put that is that the assumption of non-contextuality was already there implicitly in the definition of a quasi-probability representation, because people assumed that these guys, there would be a different function for every density operator. Not for every mixture of pure states, but for every density operator, regardless of how that density operator was made. And similarly over here, you know, for every projective measurement or every POVM measurement, you get a function for each outcome, but it's not allowed to depend on the context. So if when I showed you those definitions of non-contextuality, you thought, well, that's not particularly natural, if you write it down this way, it does seem very natural. It's so natural, in fact, that everybody who sort of wrote papers about quasi-probability representations never really bothered to measure that, to mention that implicit assumption that, you know, you could have chosen different functions for different mixtures of pure states. So what's nice about this general notion of non-contextuality is that it gives you a notion of classicality that coincides with this other notion of classicality that comes from a different set of considerations in a different community. And so if I go back to this slide I've shown you before, where you tried to classify different sorts of quantum phenomena, right? So these were the ones that arose just from imagining that the world was classical, but there's a restriction on how much you know. And then there's these other ones over here. These tend to sort of go together. There's some structure there, this sort of extra type 2 non-classicality. The notion of, you know, quasi-probability representations going negative as a kind of non-classicality turns out to be equivalent in the way I just showed to contextuality as a kind of non-classicality. Incidentally, I didn't mention it explicitly, but what that result on the last slide shows is that if you had hoped to find some quasi-probability representation where all quantum states and all quantum measurements would be represented by positive functions, you know, do better than Wigner, that hope is dashed by virtue of these no-go theorems, the Cochin-Specker theorem. because this is such a non-negative quasi-probability representation, is the same as a non-contextual ontological model, and because I've derived contradictions from the assumption of non-contextuality, you know that there is no such representation. So the bottom line is that there's the phenomena that are left over here as sort of the extra weird phenomena seem to have contextuality as a kind of umbrella. You know, we saw that non-locality is a kind of contextuality. Negativity of quasi-probability representations can be thought of as a kind of contextuality. People have speculated that maybe computational speedups might also have something to do with these phenomena. I'm going to end there. That's the real difficulty. I don't think I have anything else to say. That's right. That's the real difficulty with hidden variable approaches, explaining this sort of stuff. But nonetheless, people have tried to come up with hidden variable models. And tomorrow, we'll be talking about one of them, probably the most popular one, which is called the de Broglie-Bohm interpretation. And then from then, we'll look at the others.